WFAE streaming is sponsored by Corporate Information Technologies, a local IT company assisting business and taking a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Most conversations about climate change center on the melting polar ice caps and glaciers and the potential for rising sea levels. Some get into the particulars of the impact of a warming globe on food supplies and animal migration patterns. But what about humans? How will climate change affect us? That's actually the wrong question. The more accurate question is, how is climate change already affecting us? Because scientists say it is. They believe climate change is already harming our health, and it will only get worse. And here to enlighten us on that troubling prospect are Drs. Jeremy Hess and Karen Yates. Dr. Hess is on the faculty at Emory University in the Department of Emergency Medicine and the Department of Environmental Health. He also serves as Senior Medical Advisor for the Climate and Health Program of the National Center of Environmental Health at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. Thank you for being with us in our Spirit Square studio this morning.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And Dr. Hess will actually be conducting a webinar at 11 o'clock today on behalf of Clean Air Carolina on climate change, managing the shifting environmental health risks. And information on how to tune into that, so to speak, is on our website at WFAE.org. And also with us by phone is Dr. Karen Yates, an epidemiologist and research assistant professor at the UNC Gilling School of Global Public Health at UNC Chapel Hill. Dr. Yates is co-chair also of the Asthma Alliance of North Carolina. Welcome to you.
Oh, thank you very much, Mike.
Now, in the aftermath of the recession, there was a lot of talk about the decrease in wealth and buying power being the new normal of the economy. Is this recent rash of extreme weather events, from floods to droughts to tornadoes to hurricane, the one that went up the East Coast, I can't remember the name of it, is that the new normal for the climate now?
Well, it's difficult to say with a lot of certainty, particularly based on a short period of time, whether we've entered a new phase or not. But what we do know about climate change is that there's more energy in the atmosphere. We expect more extreme precipitation events. We expect more extreme weather events such as heat waves. And some of those events may be just a little bit more dramatic than we've seen in the past. Some of them may be much more dramatic than we've seen in the past. And we expect them to occur with greater frequency as well. So with Hurricane Sandy, we certainly can't attribute Hurricane Sandy to climate change per se, but the pattern of Hurricane Sandy 3 years after Hurricane Irene hitting that region is unusual historically, and certainly we're seeing similar constellations in other parts of the world in terms of extreme events. So it's a distinct possibility.
So if this is something that is the new normal, or at least it's a period of time in which we have rising temperatures, and maybe they'll drop in 10 years, who knows, mm-hmm. but rising temperatures and increasing more violent, more frequent, more devastating storm activity, what are the implications for human populations beyond the potential for property destruction and injury from those events?
Sure. Well, and in the litany of issues that you brought up at the beginning, there are hints of the exposures that are relevant for human health. The main issues with climate change are, of course, that the temperature rises. And as a result of the temperature rising, you have other significant changes. One of them is sea level rise, and that happens for two reasons. One, water expands as it's warmer. And two, we have melting of land-based ice, and that flows into the oceans. And then also we have more energy in our weather systems, as I mentioned. And so we have a range of direct and indirect effects. We have direct exposures like increased heat. We have injuries from storms and flooding. We have displacement, population displacement, like we saw with Hurricane Katrina. Again, not attributing Katrina to climate change, but the effects that we saw associated with Katrina and Rita are very similar to what you would expect with any major storm. And we had significant population displacement and disruption there, a lot of adverse mental health effects, depression, exacerbations of chronic conditions because people are without their medications or without their social support systems. We are likely to see some impacts on food, as you mentioned, decreased quality of food supplies and in some places decreased quantity of food. In other places, we'll probably see some salutary effects. It'll be warmer, so there may be less cold-associated morbidity and mortality, morbidity meaning illness and mortality meaning death. but on balance, we are concerned that most of the health effects, direct and indirect, will be adverse.
Most of the things that we see in the media with regard to climate change have to do with all the things I mentioned before, the storms, et cetera, and the damage that occur from the storms, melting ice, polar bears being stranded on disconnected ice flows, thawing permafrost, the parching drought. Not much about human health impact. I'm curious, Dr. Yates, why that is. Is it because it's just something that we're beginning to understand?
Yeah, that's a good question, Mike. And I think part of it is that there have been some studies that have shown, particularly the researchers focusing on extreme heat events. And so we know, like the heat wave that happened in Chicago, the one that happened in France several years ago, there are large effects when you have those extended heat waves on the health, especially for vulnerable populations of both the elderly and young children. And we saw with the heat wave in Chicago and in France that that the elderly were at particular risk and had a much higher rate of dying than they normally would, and you know, that it was sort of a precipitating event and very stressful, and also for those that are of lower wealth or are resource poor, they don't necessarily have the means to get to cooler places, and so there have been studies showing this increasing in temperature and some scenarios. Well, I mean, one of the problems is in doing research like this that it's challenging. You know, we're trying to guess what it's going to be like in 2020, 2030, 2050. So we have these fairly sophisticated models, but there's still a lot of error. And so when we try to estimate the effects in the future, we have to be concerned with how these models are predicting changes, and then related to that, how we then predict the related illness and deaths that are associated with increases in and changes in the environment due to climate change.
But now, in the very beginning of the program, I said that scientists believe that climate change is already having a negative impact on human health. The two of you agree with that? You're shaking. You're nodding your head in agreement with that, Dr. Hess.
Yes.
And
yes.
Dr.
Yes.
Yates. So you both agree with that.
Yes.
We have a lot of people who are concerned about vegetation, about the trees. They're concerned about the effect of drought on farming. They're concerned about the polar bears who are being stranded on these ice flows. Wouldn't everybody in those three categories be more concerned about the impact on human health? Because it's them.
Certainly, in theory, they would.
So then, why don't we hear more about that aspect of this? It would seem to me that that aspect of this, and hearing more about it, and hearing more scientific, empirical evidence about it, would cause people to say, we need to do something.
I agree completely.
Dr. Yates?
I think human behavior is complicated, and I think sometimes people don't necessarily want to change unless they see there's a direct effect on them specifically. And so that's part of the challenge, to make those connections with, oh boy, we've had like a 5-day heat wave of over 100. Boy, my grandmother, never said that, we ever had that before. How unusual. Could that be related to climate change? There's still a lot of politically motivated discussions about climate change. And so it's sometimes there's conflicting things that people hear on the radio and on the news about, if what they're seeing is truly climate change or not.
One of the sidebar topics when we talk about climate change or the potential for climate change or the possibility of it is time. The question of time. How much time do we have? How urgent is this problem? And there's arguments about that, obviously. With regard to health concerns, How urgent would you say this is? How much time do we have to understand the health issues and then step in to address them?
Well, it depends on where you're talking about. Part of the difficulty, and something that Karen alluded to, is that different places experience different effects. So in the Northeast, there may be an extension of suitable Lyme disease habitat. It may be extending up into Canada. In the Northwest, we see new outbreaks of fungal diseases that weren't there previously. In other places, we see different health impacts associated with increased pollen levels or adverse exposure to extreme heat. So in different places, you have different hazards.
But, you know, the world, there are places in the world where people have lived with extreme heat for millennia. Why would we suddenly be – obviously, certain things won't grow when the temperature reaches 100 year-round. But, I mean, why would we be suddenly adversely affected in terms of our health?
Well, we're not suddenly adversely affected. All of these exposures have impacts on us already. So places that are very hot and have periodic extreme heat events, people get ill and die from those extreme heat events already. So one of the important things to understand is that climate change amplifies existing exposures. And those existing exposures already have health impacts. In some places, those health impacts are readily apparent. In other places, they're sort of a little more subtle, fall into a background. But with climate change going forward, we expect that that amplification will cause more pronounced sickness and ill health.
And if I understand this correctly, Dr. Yates, that's one of the things that you have been looking at, particularly with regard to asthma and allergies and things like that. I'm just curious as to why or how rising temperatures, climate change, can increase the incidence of asthma and allergies and things like that.
The work that I've done, and that, this is with colleagues of mine in the Institute of the Environment here at UNC, we were looking at changes in synoptic patterns in the weather, which actually those are air masses that change over time, and they're what you see when you watch the weatherman giving the or weatherwoman giving the prediction for what the weather is going to be like tomorrow. These changes, like we have a say a dry polar coming mass coming this way, so we were looking at those because those patterns of weather actually are predicted to change over time, and we think that they and it's been shown that they also affect air pollutants. So we were looking at those changes in relation to several known pollutants, ozone and PM, and looking at hospitalizations and emergency room visits related to the air pollution under these different air masses. And so, and we did find some associations that under, moist tropical weather patterns or air masses that there and increased ozone, there were more likely to be hospitalizations related to asthma and also to heart attacks. And so the idea is then we know that if in North Carolina specifically, it's predicted to become more moist and hotter over time, say by 2030 or 2050. And so we would then predict that there would be even more asthma-related hospitalizations, ER visits, and also increases in myocardial infarctions or heart attacks related to those changes.
I only have 30 seconds left in this segment, but in places that are already warm and humid, like the equator, are we already seeing that? Is that traditional in those areas, more asthma, more heart attacks?
There haven't been that many studies. I mean, I think like they're in some large cities, you might be able to see those changes, but there hasn't really been that much done on.
Okay, we have to stop. I'm going to come back on the other side. We'll finish up. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and UNC TV's Winterfest 2012, presenting Superbrain with Dr. Rudy Tanzi tonight at 8. Information at unctv.org. And Tyndall Subaru in Gastonia, representing the full line of Subaru vehicles, parts, and service, including the 2013 Crosstrek. Now presenting Share the Love in support of the USO. Details at TyndallSubaru.com. Well, because we're a banking and financial services center, talk over the looming fiscal cliff. Well, it's got some ears perked up here. We're paying close attention because this town has a lot invested in the outcome. So we're calling on two local economic experts to offer some perspective on the situation and what the various possible outcomes of the debate in Washington might mean for you and for us collectively. Chris Clackham will be here as guest host tomorrow to welcome those folks in a conversation about avoiding the fiscal cliff tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Newark, New Jersey Mayor Cory Booker is the latest politician to highlight the challenges of getting government food assistance. But some say the U.S. food stamp program needs cutbacks. The challenge of feeding America's hungry.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. In our studio, Dr. Jeremy Hess with Emory University, an emergency medical physician and epidemiologist. Also, Dr. Karen Yates joins us by phone, also an epidemiologist and research assistant professor at the UNC Gilling School of Global Public Health at UNC Chapel Hill and co-chair of the Asthma Alliance of North Carolina. Just prior to the break, we were talking about the impact of increasing heat and ozone on hospitalizations associated with asthma and rise in cardiac problems. And I asked Dr. Yates the question, since we're seeing this here and we can correlate it here in increased weather conditions, where it's always been warm around the world, at the equator, is that the norm? And I had to interrupt your answer to that question, Dr. Yates.
Yes, I think, when we see in countries around the equator where there are increases in ozone, that there are increases in asthma hospitalizations and heart attacks related to the air pollutants, I think there is some level of adaptation for people that live in warm climates all year around, but it has been difficult to tease out in those areas. Whether, you know, it's climate change-related increases, it's very difficult to say.
Epidemiologist George Luber, who is one of your colleagues, I think, at the Center for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, says the most obvious risk from a warming world is killer heat. Is that the most obvious risk or the biggest risk or simply the most obvious one?
I think it's probably the most obvious one. I mean, it's the most directly related to climate change and the one that people most clearly associate. The largest on a population level is probably diarrheal disease globally.
Diarrheal disease?
Diarrheal disease.
Which is a pathogen. From what? From water ingestion or bad food or what?
Primarily from water. And right, so it's
is that in the first world or the third world, so to speak?
That will be more the third world.
Okay,
but when we're talking on a population level in terms of population health impacts of climate change globally, that's the largest.
Because I was going to ask you what the areas of concern are for epidemiologists with regard to this, because I know that there's a lot of different things aside from just heat waves that concern you about rising global temperatures if they take place. What are some of the? I know asthma and respiratory allergies and airway diseases are one.
Certainly, respiratory issues are one set. Injuries, as you mentioned, and you know, from lots of different sources. We are worried about all sorts of ecosystem changes. So changes that would result in shifts in vector-borne and zoonotic disease being diseases transmitted by animals.
Like Lyme disease.
Correct. That would be a vector-borne disease. That's the most common vector-borne disease in the United States. And we are worried that the range for Lyme disease will be expanding westward and northward as a result of warming and other ecological changes.
One of the other changes that I read about yesterday was human developmental effects. I don't know which one of you I should ask about that, but what are we talking about here when we talk about human developmental effects because of climate change?
Well, we don't know much about that. Some of our concerns are based on what we know about physiology and how temperature may affect physiology. We know we're getting emerging evidence that extreme heat can affect in utero development and cause some issues for fetuses. Recently, there was some evidence around cataracts in fetuses during
during
extreme temperatures, gestations during extreme temperatures. I don't know what the mechanism is for that, but then there are also some neurodevelopmental effects that may result as a result of what we call mobilization of toxicants from the environment. So, say you have different chemicals that are locked up in ice or soil, and then they're somehow liberated as a result of ecological shifts from climate change, principally warming, then they would get into human populations.
So we have this possibility of the increase of asthma, respiratory diseases, cardiovascular disease, which we've talked a little bit about, and stroke, foodborne diseases, and nutritional problems because of decline in food availability, heat-related morbidity and mortality, human developmental effects, mental health and stress-related disorders, waterborne diseases, weather-related morbidity and mortality, and the list goes on and on. How many of these possible problems are just that, maybe, versus how many of these do we have empirical evidence on that says unequivocally this is going to be or is already a problem?
Well, you listed quite a litany, and I don't know if I can go through point by point and
all
say
came from you guys.
No, I mean, I could. I just don't know if we have enough time on the radio to go through point by point in each disease, and we could assess the level of evidence around it. I mean, the evidence that things are happening right now in terms of human health effects is a little thin, but it's partially because – for two reasons, really. One, there's only so much research funding available to study some of these things. And it takes a while to study them. So the evidence we accumulate takes a while, and we can't look at all the different problems at once. but also we don't – scientists are inherently conservative. I don't mean that in a political sense. I mean that they don't want to overstate the findings that are in front of them. And with climate change, it's a slowly evolving exposure, and it's – evolving in the setting of all these other things that happen. And we don't want to attribute an observation around a health effect.
And yet you are here to talk about,
sure,
not on this program alone, but also in the webinar that you're doing for Clean Air Carolina at 11 today. You're here to talk about climate change, managing the shifting environmental health risks. So you must feel fairly confident that something is happening right now.
I do.
But you're not able to say precisely what's happening in each of these areas? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying, if you want to give me 45 minutes, we can go through point by point, and I'll give you a summary of the evidence around each of those issues.
All right.
So,
but there is what I'm getting at is that there is evidence.
Yes, there is evidence.
Okay.
And some of that evidence – I'm sorry, go ahead, Karen.
Oh, I was going to say, there's enough evidence, for example, that the CDC has funded 10 different states across the nation to start developing climate readiness plans. And North Carolina was one of the lucky ones. For example, in Wilmington, there were 13.8 more days than expected of extreme heat over 2000 to 2009. So we do see these even, and I think that people need to be made more aware and really to start to plan for these changes.
Let's talk about that CDC designation. I read that North Carolina is identified as a Category 1 state by the CDC, with health impacts listed as temperature-related morbidity and mortality, extreme weather, air pollution, water, food, and vector-borne diseases. Define Category 1. What does that mean, Dr. Yates?
Well, there were two types of grants that were awarded, and five in each category, as I understand it. That one was more about the assessment and planning to develop climate change programs, and the second is to build capacity to implement the climate change program. So North Carolina is in the Category 1, or the assessment and planning to develop climate change programs, and this effort's being led by Lauren Tay, who's in the Division of Public Health at North Carolina, and she's been working very hard with many different agencies in the state to help develop these programs.
Now, at the same time that the CDC is giving North Carolina money to help plan for the changes brought by climate change, in the recent session of the North Carolina legislature, they cast themselves, in a way, as climate change deniers when they suggested that coastal areas plan for rising sea levels using past history instead of scientific predictions of where we are headed. So with that as a backdrop, where are we with regard to climate change from the perspective of state government? Dr. Yates, you're the North Carolinian here.
That's a good question. I think there are many people that are working both at a state level within various departments, including the Department of Environmental and Natural Resources, as well as people within the State Health Department and the Division of Public Health. And they also are partnering with advocacy groups such as those of Clean Air North Carolina that's supporting the webinar briefly. And though it is, there is a lot of discussion about that, and it's not clear how the efforts will go forward with the new administration.
So the Center for Disease Control Climate Ready Initiative grants, what will that allow North Carolina and the other states who are receiving these grants to do?
I think it's, part of it, as you alluded to earlier in the show, was this component of education of the population and, trying to relate, the climate change that we don't necessarily see in our daily lives, and to sort of show how it can be related to our daily lives, and to encourage people to change behaviors in their own lives that can also, like reducing car trips or trying to recycle more. Just sort of generally, like, there are many things, use less energy. So there are, small efforts that can be made by many people. So I think part of that some part of the effort is focused on educating. Jeremy, would you like, I think you could also, you have a larger CDC perspective on this.
Mm-hmm. Your outline earlier of the different categories and the emphasis on assessment and then planning and preparedness was good. And the efforts that CDC is funding will support that in different states. And so different states have identified a sort of handful of climate-sensitive conditions that they're concerned about in their particular area. And so they are using the funds to assess the degree to which they're vulnerable and their populations are vulnerable to those concerns, and then shore up programs that they already have in existence to deal with those issues or create new ones in certain cases. And their activities range from some research looking back in time recently to see what the relationship might be between extreme heat exposure and emergency department visits, for instance, up through shoring up heat wave preparedness plans or other sorts of disaster preparedness plans, and in certain cases looking at critical infrastructure that's really not within the public health sector per se, but maybe looking at the electrical grid or at where generators are placed in hospitals and other critical infrastructure, and things that affect health indirectly, and trying to assess all of that and then determine what they can do going forward to minimize the risks.
Is this a hard sell? Because there are people out there who simply don't believe this is happening, or don't believe that we can do anything about it, or that the Earth goes in cycles, and it does go in cycles. There are periods of extreme heat, and there are periods of extreme cold. We know that. Mm-hmm. So is it a hard sell when you talk about this? Do people just go, are there deniers out there?
Well, there certainly are deniers out there, and the way that I tend to approach this is very similar, actually, to the way that I approach counseling around health-related issues with my patients. So if I have a patient who comes to the emergency department complaining of a headache, and we find that their blood pressure is really high, mm-hmm. and they didn't know that they had high blood pressure, some of that may be related to pain, just a transient reaction to the pain, but probably underlying it is a true elevation in blood pressure. Of course, we only have that one measurement in time. But what I say to them is, listen, I will treat your pain and we'll try and figure out what's causing your headache. So I want you to be feel relieved about that. But we've also identified this other issue that I know from looking at all sorts of other patients, and our total experience around high blood pressure puts you at risk for any number of issues. Some of them may actually be related to your headache, and we're going to evaluate that today and determine whether there's a risk. But otherwise, we need to control that risk long term. Mm-hmm. And so we may need to make modifications in your diet and try and bring down your risk for high blood pressure generally. We may need to put you on medication and try and treat it if we can't eliminate the risk using other methods. And over time, we hopefully can control some of the downstream health impacts that might come from that risk that we've identified at that point in time. I don't really necessarily need to go into the cause of it. I mean, to some degree, the cause is important to discuss if it's readily identifiable and easily reduced or eliminated. But the problem is there, and we need to deal with it. And for all these things, the problem is already here, as I mentioned, for a lot of these diseases, not all of them. Some of them are going to be diseases in new places that we haven't seen them before. But for the most part, a lot of these conditions in a well-developed country like the United States, we already deal with them, and we try and manage these risks already. We just need to shore up our risk management processes better.
Do you find, Dr. Yates, when you talk to lay people about this, that they more readily accept a conversation on this topic when it talks about their personal health and about the health of their family and those around them than they would if we just talked about this in terms of saving the glaciers?
Yes, definitely. I think that's one way in which people make behavior changes, and that is important to realize that, you know, small actions taken over a large collective group of people can make a big change. I actually thinking about the, you know, you had mentioned earlier, you know, the skepticism, and but I think there's also sort of some generational differences, and there's just an article today in the paper about the college students across the nation, you know, trying to convince their administrations to divest their portfolios of funds, you know, related to coal and gas-related production, similar to how there were protests, you know, with South Africa. So I think they're, you know, like trying to, you know, see that how these interests are associated and pressures from, say, younger generational groups might also bring it again to the forefront. I mean, because there are many people around the world that are working on this, but, you know, it's really challenging. There are a lot of political sort of intricacies in this, and you know, on our energy sector is also really important, and it's interesting that, you know, in some ways that's very connected to our health.
Is that where it has to come from the energy and the idealism of young people as opposed to older people who only have a few more years left?
No, not at all. I don't mean to give that. No. I think it needs to be across many different age groups and of all levels of society. But again, going back is making that connection that, you know, that you see these changes when you walk outside and, oh, we're having another extreme weather event.
Well, if on December the 4th, people in Chicago are wearing short sleeve shirts instead of mukluks, then you know that something is going on, and that's what happened up there yesterday.
Yes.
Who is affected most by this? What are there certain age groups that would be more affected than others by illness due to climate or stress due to climate change?
Well, I think the elderly are at particular risk, particularly those of with lower wealth and lower resources, you know, because, I mean, in general, in North Carolina, we do have, you know, more people have air conditioning than, say, up north. But there's still, if you don't have that much money and you have to make a decision between cooling your house and what food you're going to eat, I mean, of course, you're going to choose food. And I was just, you know, over the summer talking with my air conditioning, the fellow, who the HVAC person, and he's like, he sees people all the time suffering in the heat. I mean, you know, people that can't afford to get their AC fixed or, you know, they're trying to save money. I mean, so I think we have to think about our most vulnerable groups in North Carolina and across the nation.
Dr. Karen Yates with UNC Gilling School of Global Public Health at UN's Chapel has to leave us to go something else at this moment. So I thank you for your time today, and we'll come back with Dr. Jeremy Hess after the break. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Cannon School, hosting a first-grade information session where students, teachers, and leaders show how the school's youngest students are learning to become adaptive experts. Tomorrow at 10 a.m., details at cannonschool.org. And Charlotte Family Psychiatry and Counseling Services, providing treatment for bipolar disorder, ADHD, anxiety, and depression. Available details at cltfamilypsych.com. Mayor Cory Booker of Newark is the latest politician to highlight the challenges for people who rely on government assistance for food, but some say the U.S. food stamp program needs to be cut back. The challenge of feeding America's hungry, the topic at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to talk about our topic today, which is the health effects of climate change, 704-926-WFAE, 800-603-WFAE, which is 9323, or WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. Coming right back.
President Obama's first term is about to go into the history books. What do African Americans think of his White House tenure so far?
He's like the Gorbachev of black presidents. He's ushering in racial glasnost.
Black voters on the first black president. That's later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us this afternoon from 4 till 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. In our studio here at Spirit Square, Dr. Jeremy Hess, emergency medical physician and epidemiologist with Emory University in the Department of Emergency Medicine and the Department of Environmental Health, also a senior medical advisor on climate and health at the CDC in Atlanta. He'll be doing a webinar on this topic, climate change and health, at 11 o'clock on behalf of Clean Air Carolina, and information on that is on our website at WFAE.org. When you do a webinar, exactly what is that for people who have never been experienced?
It's essentially a presentation using PowerPoint broadcast over the web. So the audio and the visuals are broadcast, and then like you, we take written questions and try and answer them at the end of the presentation.
Jessica in Charlotte couldn't hold, but she writes, there are health effects for other creatures besides humans. She's noticed her dogs are particularly miserable right now because the fleas are really bad this year. Her vet said a lot of people have the same complaints because the mild winter last year didn't wipe out the fleas. I would think that this is one of the things that you epidemiologists and others like you who study pest-borne diseases are concerned about.
Yes, we are concerned about it. Not necessarily principally for the dog's welfare, though we, you know, as a dog lover, we're concerned about that. But it speaks to ecological dynamics that we see happening all over the world. And when you have pests that are killed over winter, typically, and you have a mild winter and those pests are not killed, or the populations, not as many of them are killed, then later, the following year, or sometimes even a couple years down the road, you see a surge. And that can result in increased disease transmission to humans.
Mm-hmm. And could that be part of why last summer Texas had an alarm, and other parts in the South, had an alarming increase in the incidence of West Nile virus?
It certainly could, yes. There are several factors there. I think the milder winters are part of it, and then also the warmer summers are part of it. Because with mosquitoes, when it's warmer, they breed more quickly. Their metabolic rates are higher, so they're more active when it's warmer. They bite at a higher rate. And then you also have higher rates of pathogen replication inside the vector, inside
Why?
The mosquito.
Because it would seem to me that body temperature doesn't vary all that much, does it?
Well, those animals don't regulate their body temperatures within a narrow range like we do. And so when it's warmer, everything speeds up in them up to a point. At a certain point, that it'd be too hot. But up to a point, everything speeds up. And their metabolic activity, the activity of the pathogen. So everything's on.
Well, things like the flu. We're entering flu season, mm-hmm. and it's supposed to be a pretty bad flu season.
That's our concern,
telling us
yeah.
now. And that happens usually when the weather gets cooler.
Right.
Or cold. What kinds of illnesses seem to be exacerbated when the weather and the climate gets hotter?
Well, again,
will we see flu go away?
No, we certainly won't see flu go away. We may see decreases in cold-related illness mm-hmm. and death. Mm-hmm. And so it's important to recognize that there's a net effect here. There's a set of adverse impacts, and then there's a set of boons to health. And we have to be careful to
– Do they offset each other?
Well, they offset each other to some degree, and you have to, in your accounting in a given place, look and see what you expect.
So is part of the problem here in certain areas of the country, like in the Northeast and even here in the South, because mm-hmm. we're not into the deep South here, mm-hmm. That we will see diseases that people know about and have to deal with in warmer climates that we're simply not accustomed to dealing with, and it will be a kick in the pants for us?
That's potentially what would happen. Not here in North Carolina, we're probably a little far north to be concerned about this right now, but further south, we are seeing a reemergence of dengue, for instance. Dengue
in America?
Yes, in America. Well, it's actually been here pretty much steadily in parts of Texas for a long time.
So dengue fever is what?
dengue fever is a viral disease that causes significant – it causes fevers and really bad aches. And there are four different types of the virus. And if you get infected with – or if you get infected with one strain and then you get reinfected with that strain, then you can get something called breakbone fever, which is very uncomfortable but also has a significant mortality rate. Wow. And so that's relatively rare, so you'd be reinfected with the same strain.
So do we understand why a virus would be more affected by a rise in temperature and more active or more lethal?
Well, it's again, it goes back to the disease ecology. So it's not that the virus is more lethal per se. It's that
– more prevalent.
Right. That the ways in which that virus may be transmitted are affected by changes in the ecology, principally temperature, maybe rainfall. And when you put those factors into – you overlay human ecology onto it, then you may have a real problem with managing the disease. Now, in the case of flu, in fact, you may see a decrease in the incidence of flu going forward because it's warmer and it is typically a cold season disease.
So it's easy to understand something like the flu or something like a pathogen-borne illness that flourishes in warmer climates or things that attack crops or things like that in a warmer climate. It's not so easy to understand the correlation between warmer climates and a rise in cancer or a warmer climates and a rise in stroke or cardiovascular disease. So explain that. What is the relationship?
Well, again, it depends on the specific disease. So if you're talking about cancer, that risk is largely theoretical. We haven't identified any clear cases of that. But as I mentioned earlier, one of the concerns that we have is that there are certain carcinogenic chemicals that are locked up in certain environmental substrates. And you might see this, for instance, in Alaska, where there are some chemicals locked up in permafrost or in ice. And as it melts and as the ecosystem changes there, those chemicals get liberated into the environment and move into the environment in ways that people might be able to be exposed to them, either through food or drinking water. And that if there are dioxins there, then they may be exposed to increased risks associated with dioxins. And so it's a theoretical risk. We are watching out for it. Of course, there are lags in all of these things. So even if once we start seeing warming of the permafrost, we may be some time before we would see the disease effects in humans.
Would there be a higher incidence of skin cancer because of ozone or ozone depletion? I'm not even sure what's going on there. I've heard both stories here, so I don't know.
Right. And the ozone there are interesting parallels and other issues with ozone and climate change. But the ozone layer high in the atmosphere protects us against ultraviolet radiation. Mm-hmm. And so the ozone hole in the southern hemisphere means that more UV radiation gets through that area, and that is linked to increased incidence of skin cancer. And that's definitely a risk there. But that's not a climate change effect. That's separate.
What about stroke? Why stroke?
Well, stroke, there are several different mechanisms by which you might have increased risk of stroke from warmer temperatures and poorer air quality. Basically, when it's warmer, the body works a little harder to cool itself off. And somebody who's already got underlying health issues, as most people who have a stroke do, they have high blood pressure and high cholesterol and other things that predispose them to that risk, and diabetes, et cetera, their bodies have to work harder just to stay cool and everything else during warmer temperatures. So that increased physiological stress burdens their hearts and can increase their risk of stroke.
Does the presence of air conditioning alleviate all of that?
The presence of air conditioning is very protective against the adverse health impacts of heat. Mm-hmm. But as Dr. Yates was saying earlier, even people who have air conditioning may not always be able to afford to run it.
Right.
So it is protective, but we don't have as high a penetration as we might like in certain communities. And then even if we do have penetration, they aren't able to use it always.
The health issues that have been cropping up as a result of the changing climate have been called slow and often unpredictable. And I'm wondering if we will get better at predicting what's coming our way as we focus more research in the area.
Yes, I think we will. And I would say they're unpredictable in the sense that we can't state at exactly what point in time in the near future we expect something to happen. But that has as much to do with limitations on our ability to predict the exposures as it does to predict the outcomes. If we get better at short to medium-term forecasting, and I mean months to years in terms of weather predictability, we can do a much better job than predicting the health effects that we would expect.
There's a lot of distrust on this topic. A lot of people mm-hmm. simply do not trust scientists. A lot of people do not trust politicians. Most people do, however, trust their doctors,
yes,
their physicians, and other healthcare professionals. Could the increasing understanding of the negative impacts on health of climate change be a kind of blessing here for people who are worried about this?
I think it could be. I mean, I certainly agree with you that people do trust their doctors and they tend to be skeptical of scientists. And, you know, the best physicians are physician scientists. And physicians, in my experience, being one, I work with them all the time, we're a skeptical lot. And I mean that actually in a complimentary way.
We, the public at large, or we scientists?
We physicians, actually. Okay. Physicians and physician scientists are skeptical. We like to see evidence before we recommend something or do something to a patient or a population. And so I take that same skepticism to my work on climate and health as I do to my practice in emergency medicine. So I certainly am concerned myself as a physician, as a public health provider. And I take that relationship with my patients and the populations I serve seriously. And so I'm grateful for that trust, and I am concerned about climate change. And so to the extent that people are concerned about their health and potentially the adverse health impacts of climate change, that's good to know.
One of the other bones of contention when you talk about climate change, whether you believe it or not, whether you think human beings – well, the part of the problem is people want to know, who do we blame? Do we blame ourselves for fossil fuel production and use, or is it simply the globe going through one of its long-term cycles here? Does it matter who's to blame? Whether it's natural or man-made?
Well, it matters to some degree. It doesn't matter in the sense that it's happening. And so to the extent that the trends continue, regardless of their origin, we need to anticipate that and prepare and manage the risks. But part of the risk management is, as I mentioned with the high blood pressure, identifying potentially treatable or reducible causes. Mm-hmm. So to the extent that climate change is a result of us putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, if we can limit our production of those gases and reduce the risk of long-term climate change, then we can avoid a lot of those risks. The other thing that is important is that a lot of those behaviors that reduce greenhouse gas emissions actually are really good for health, and they're really good for health almost immediately. A lot of the things that we've talked about today are going to accrue over a long period of time and rather gradually. I mean, there'll be some extreme events, and you'll have some big bumps in morbidity and mortality. But for the most part, those things are going to accumulate slowly. The things that the health benefits of reducing our reliance on coal and of increasing active transport, walking, biking, other things, those accrue over days to weeks, sometimes years. But they're very immediate and they're very dramatic.
Wow.
So that's really the good side of all of this, that to the extent that you can encourage people to walk and bike in their lives, their cardiovascular health improves, the rate of diabetes goes down, and all the complications that go along with those things go away for them.
This is not a problem just in the United States. This is a worldwide problem if it's going to happen. How concerned are other nations? How busy are other nations trying to predict what's going to happen health-wise and how to maybe ease some of the impact of climate change if it's going to happen? And how do they compare to us? Are they less concerned, more concerned, less aggressive, more aggressive? And how is it working out across the globe?
I would say generally that there is a high level of concern across the globe. And I do a fair amount of international work and have colleagues all over the world. And generally the sense that I get when they come and tell me about their home countries is that there's a lot of concern about climate change generally. There's definitely concern about climate and health, and they're moving, in some cases, quite aggressively to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but also to anticipate these health impacts and to address them.
Are we keeping pace with them?
We are keeping pace with the middle of the pack, I would say, in terms of our public health efforts generally.
And why is that?
Well, I mean,
why do we want to be number one? America, USA, USA. Why
of
do
course.
We want to be number one?
Well, to our credit, as a country, we already have a fairly robust okay. health infrastructure and public health infrastructure. So we have protections against a number of these things. And so in general, we feel fairly insulated against some of these health impacts. And to the extent, you know, you can debate whether that's justified, that feeling of comfort, because clearly we still do have health impacts from these environmental hazards. The trick is identifying where these hazards and how they're changing are going to overwhelm the protections we have in place.
If you have high blood pressure, you know you should be exercising. If you have high cholesterol, you know you should be exercising and maybe changing your diet somewhat, et cetera. What can we do in the face of this? What behavior modification can we do that would protect us from some of this if it's really a danger for us?
Well, we can invest in programs and activities that allow us to safely bike and walk. We can change the way that we eat and the way that we travel. And we can look at the parts of our lives where we emit a lot of carbon and also where we're particularly sedentary or doing things that may be bad for our health. And in those places, we can make changes.
Dr. Jeremy Hess, an emergency medicine physician and epidemiologist at Emory University and a senior medical advisor on climate and health at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. Also with us earlier today, Dr. Karen Yates, co-chair of the Asthma Alliance of North Carolina, among other things. Thank you for the hour. I appreciate it.
Thank you.